Side 7. The Shining Ones. The Tomilly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 232. On the eastern coast of far-flung Tomilly, there doth lie a road, which doth proceed southward to fire-domed Methyrian.
Yes?
When my companions and I first beheld Methyrian, we came in sight of it when we did crest a long hill.
Yes, I share thy memory of the place.
Couldst thou take us there, e'en though darkness doth cover the face of the earth?
Yes.
Sparhawk started to reach into the box for his wife's ring. Then he stopped. We share a common purpose, and thus are comrades. It is not meet that I should compel thee and whip thee into compliance with the power of Gwerig's rings. Thus I do not command thee, but request instead. Wilt thou take us to this place we both know, out of comradeship and common purpose?
I will, Annika.
Chapter 16. The blur which surrounded them momentarily was that same featureless gray, no darker than it had been when Belium had transported them in daylight. Night and day appeared to be irrelevant. Sparhawk dimly perceived that Belium took them through some different place, a colorless emptiness that adjoined all other places, a kind of doorway to everywhere.
"You were right, my lord," Calton said to Vanyan, looking up at the star-studded night sky. "It is later here, isn't it?"
He looked sharply at Zanisha, who swayed slightly in her saddle.
"Are you unwell, lady?" he asked her.
"It is of no moment, Sir Knight. A slight giddiness, nothing more."
"You get used to it. The first few times are a little unsettling, but that wears off."
Khalad held out the box, and Sparhawk put Belium back inside. "I do not do this to imprison thee," he told the jewel. "Our enemies can sense thy presence when thou art exposed, and this receptacle doth conceal thee from their search." The Belium pulsed slightly in acknowledgment. Sparhawk closed the cap over his ring, took the box from his squire, and closed it. Then he tucked it back into its usual place inside his tunic. Methyrian, ruddy with torchlight, lay below, and the pale path of light from the newly risen moon stretched from the horizon across the waters of the Tamil Sea to her doorstep, yet another of the innumerable roads leading to the city the Tamils called the center of the world.
"Are you open to a suggestion, Sparhawk?" Talon asked.
"You sound just like Tinian."
"I know. I'm sort of filling in for him while he's away. We've been out of Methyrian for a while, so we don't know what's really been going on here. Suppose I slip into town and have a look, ask a few questions, find out what we're riding into, the usual sort of thing."
Sparhawk nodded.
"All right," he said.
"That's all? Just all right? No protests? No objections? No hour-long lectures about being careful? I'm disappointed in you, Sparhawk."
"Would you listen to me if I objected or delivered a lecture?"
"No, not really."
"Why waste the time, then? You know what you're doing and how to do it. Just don't take all night."
Talon swung down from his horse and opened his saddlebags. He took out a rough, patched smock and pulled it on over his other clothes. Then he bent, rubbed his hand in the dirt of the road, and artfully smudged his face. He stirred up his hair and sifted a handful of straw from the roadside onto it.
"What do you think?" he asked Sparhawk.
"You'll do," Sparhawk shrugged.
"Spoil sport," Talon grumbled, climbing back on his horse.
"Khalad, come along. You can watch my horse for me while I sniff around." Khalad grunted, and the two rode on down the hill.
"Is the child truly so gifted?"
Zanisha asked.
"He'd be offended if you called him a child, lady," Calton replied. "And he can come closer to being invisible than anybody I know."
They drew back some distance from the road and waited. It was an hour later when Talon and his brother returned.
"Things are still more or less the way they were when we left," the boy reported.
"No open fighting in the streets, you mean?"
Ulof laughed.
"Not yet. Things are a little hectic at the palace, though. It's got something to do with documents of some kind. The whole government's in an uproar. None of the people I talked with knew all that much about it. The church knights and the Aetons are still in control, though, so it's safe to jump from here to the courtyard of Aelana's castle if we want. Sparhawk shook his head.
Let's ride in. I'm sure there are still Tommels inside the walls, and probably half of them are spies. Let's not give away any secrets if we don't have to. Is Sarabian still staying in the castle?
Talon nodded. Your wife's probably been teaching him a few tricks. Roll over, play dead, sit up and beg, that sort of thing.
Talon, Itanya exclaimed.
You haven't met our queen yet, have you, Your Excellency?
Talon grinned.
I'd say that you're in for a whole new experience.
It has to do with setting up the new filing system, my lord, the young Pandian at the drawbridge explained in reply to Vanyan's question. We needed room to rearrange things, so we spread all the government files out on the lawn.
What if it rains?
That would probably simplify the job a great deal, my lord.
They dismounted in the courtyard and went up the broad stairs to the ornately carved main door, paused briefly to put on the cushioned shoes that protected the brittle floor covering, and went inside. Queen Aelana had been advised of their arrival, and she was waiting for them at the door to the throne room. Sparhawk's heart caught in his throat as he looked at his lovely young wife.
"So nice of you to stop by, Sir Sparhawk," she said tartly before she threw her arms about his neck.
"Sorry we're so late, dear," he apologized after they had exchanged a brief, formal sort of kiss. "Our travel plans got a little skewed."
He was painfully conscious of the half-dozen or so Tommels lingering nearby, trying to look very hard as if they weren't listening.
"Why don't we go on upstairs, my queen? We've got quite a bit to tell you, and I'd like to get out of this male shirt before it permanently embeds itself into my skin."
"You are not going to wear that stinking thing into my bedroom, Sparhawk. As I remember, the baths lie in that general direction. Why don't you take your fragrant friends and go make use of them? The ladies can come with me. I'll round up the others, and we'll all meet you in the royal quarters in about an hour. I'm sure your explanation of your tardiness will be absolutely fascinating."
Sparhawk felt much better after he had bathed and changed into the conventional doublet and hose. He and his friends trooped up the stairs that mounted into the central tower where the royal apartments were located.
"You're late, Sparhawk,"
Mirtai said bluntly when they reached the top of the stairs.
"Yes, my wife's already pointed that out to me. Come inside. You'll need to hear this, too."
Aelana and the others who had remained behind were gathered in the large, blue-draped sitting room. Sophronia and Danae were conspicuously absent, however.
"Well, finally,"
Emperor Sarabian said as they entered. Sparhawk was startled by the change in the Emperor's appearance. His hair was tied back from his face. He wore tight-fitting black hose and a full-sleeved linen shirt. He looked younger for some reason, and he was holding a rapier with a kind of familiarity that spoke of much practice.
"Now we can get on with the business of overthrowing the government."
"What have you been up to, Aelana?" Sparhawk asked.
"Sarabian and I have been expanding our horizons."
She shrugged.
"I knew I shouldn't have stayed away so long."
"I'm glad you brought that up. That very same thought's been on my mind for the longest time now."
"Why don't you just save yourself some time and unpleasantness, Sparhawk?" Calton suggested. "Just show her why we had to take this little trip."
"Good idea." Sparhawk reached inside his doublet and took out the unadorned gold box.
"Things were beginning to get out of hand, Aelana, so we decided to go fetch some reinforcements."
"I thought that's what Tinian was doing."
"The situation called for something a little more significant than the church knights."
Sparhawk touched the band of his ring to the lid of the box.
"Open," he said.
He kept the lid partially closed to conceal the fact that his wife's ring was also inside.
"What have you done with your ring, Sparhawk?"
she asked him, looking at the cover concealing the stone.
"I'll explain in a bit."
He reached in and took out the bellium.
"This is why we had to leave, dear."
He held up the stone. She stared at it, the color draining from her face.
"Sparhawk," she gasped.
"What a magnificent jewel!" Sarabian exclaimed, reaching his hand out toward the sapphire rose.
"That might not be wise, Your Majesty," Itania cautioned. "That's the bellium. It tolerates Sparhawk, but it might pose some dangers to anyone else."
"Bellium's a fairy tale, Itania."
"I've been reassessing my position on various fairy tales lately, Your Majesty. Sparhawk destroyed Azash with bellium, just by touching it to him. I don't advise putting your hands on it, my Emperor. You've shown some promise in the past few months, and we'd sort of hate to lose you at this point."
"Itania," Oscania said sharply,
"mind your manners. We're here to advise the Emperor, brother mine, not to coddle him. Oh, incidentally, Oscania, when you sent me to Sinestra, you invested me with plenipotentiary powers, didn't you? We can check over my commission if you like, but I'm fairly sure I had that kind of authority. I usually do. I hope you don't mind, old boy, but I've concluded a couple of alliances along the way." He paused. "Well," he amended, "Sparhawk did all the real work, but my commission put some slight stain of legality on the business."
"You can't do that without consulting Mithurin first, Itania." Oscania's face was turning purple.
"Oh, be serious, Oscania. All I did was seize some opportunities that presented themselves, and I was hardly in a position to tell Sparhawk what he could or couldn't do. Now was I? I had things more or less under control in Sinestra when Sparhawk and his friends dropped by. We left Sinestra and—"
"Details, Itania. What did you do in Sinestra?"
Itania sighed. "You can be so tedious at times, Oscania. I found out that Ambassador Tarbell was in bed with Khanzad, the Interior Ministry's station chief. They had King Jalua pretty much dancing to their tune."
Oscania's face went bleak. "Tarbell's defected to Interior?"
"I thought I just said that. You might want to run a quick evaluation of your other embassies, too. Interior Minister Kolata's been very busy. Anyway, I threw Tarbell and Khanzad, along with the entire police force and most of the embassy staff, into a dungeon, declared martial law, and put the Eitan garrison in charge."
"You did what?"
"I'll write you a report about it one of these days. You know me well enough to know that I had justification."
"You exceeded your authority, Itania."
"You didn't impose any limitations on me, old boy. That gave me carte blanche. All you said was to have a look around and to do what needed to be done. So I did."
"How did you persuade the Eitans to go along with you without written authorization?"
Itania shrugged. "The commander of the Eitan garrison there is a fairly young woman, quite attractive, actually, in a muscular sort of way. I seduced her. She was an enthusiastic seducee. Believe me, Oscania, she'll do absolutely anything for me." He paused. "You might want to make note of that in my file. Something about my willingness to make sacrifices for the Empire and all that. I didn't give her total free rein, though. The dear child wanted to give me the heads of Tarbell and Khanzad as tokens of her affection, but I declined. My rooms at the university are cluttered enough already, so I don't really have the space for stuffed trophies on the walls. I told her to lock them up instead, and to keep a firm grip on King Jalua until Tarbell's replacement arrived. You needn't hurry with that appointment, my brother. I have every confidence in her."
"You've set back relations with Sinestra by 20 years, Itania."
"What relations?" Itania snorted. "The Sinestrans respond only to naked force, so that's what I used on them."
"You spoke of alliances, Itania," Sarabian said, flicking the tip of his rapier. "Just exactly to whom have you committed my undying trust and affection?"
"I was just coming to that, Your Majesty. After we left Sinestra, we went on to Delphaeus. We spoke with their chieftain, the Enerai, a very old man named Sedan, and he offered his assistance. Sparhawk's going to take care of our side of the bargain, so there's no cost to the Empire involved."
Oscania shook his head. "It must come from our mother's side of the family, Your Majesty," he apologized. "There was an uncle of hers that was always a little strange."
"What are you talking about, Oscania?"
"My brother's obvious insanity, Your Majesty. I'm told that things like that are hereditary. Fortunately, I favor our father's side of the family. Tell me, Itania,
Are you hearing voices, too? Do you have visions of purple giraffes?
You can be so tiresome sometimes, Oscania. Would you tell us what happened, Sparhawk?
Sarabian asked.
Itania covered it fairly well, Your Majesty. I take it that you Tamils have some reservations about the Shining Ones?
No, Oscania said. I wouldn't call them reservations, Your Highness. How could we have any reservations about a people who don't exist?
This argument could go on all night, Calton said. Would you mind, lady?
He asked Zanisha, who sat quietly beside him with her head slightly bowed.
If you don't show them who you are, they'll wrangle for days.
An it please thee, Sir Knight,
she replied. So formal, my dear? Sarabian smiled. Here in Mathurian we only use that mode of speech at weddings, funerals, coronations, and other mournful events.
We have long been isolate, Emperor Sarabian, she replied, and unmoved by the winds of fashion and the inconstant tides of usage. I do assure thee that we find no inconvenience in what must seem to thee forced archaism, for it cometh to our lips unbidden, and is our natural mode of speech. Upon such rare occasions when speech among us is even needful.
The door at the far end of the room opened, and Princess Danae, dragging Rollo behind her, entered quietly, with Aileen close behind her. Zanisha's eyes widened, and her expression became awed.
She fell asleep,
the little princess reported to her mother.
Is she all right?
Aelana asked.
Lady Sophronia seemed very tired, Your Majesty, Aileen responded. She bathed and went directly to bed. I couldn't even interest her in any supper.
It's probably best to just let her sleep, Aelana said. I'll look in on her later.
Emperor Sarabian had obviously taken advantage of the brief interruption to frame his thoughts in a somewhat studied archaism.
Verily, he said to Zanisha, thy mode of speech doth fall prettily upon mine ear, lady. In truth, however, thou hast been unkind to absent thyself from us, for thou art fair, and thine elegant mode of address would have added lustre to our court. Moreover, thine eyes and thy gentle demeanor do shine forth from thee, and would have provided instruction by ensample for they who are about me.
Thy words are artfully honeyed, Majesty,
Zanisha said, politely inclining her head,
and I do perceive that thou art a consummate flatterer.
Say not so, he protested. I do assure thee that I speak truly from mine heart.
He was obviously enjoying himself. She sighed.
Thine opinion, I do fear me, will change when thou dost behold me in my true state. I have altered mine appearance as necessary subterfuge to avoid affrighting thy subjects, for, though it doth cause me grave distress to confess it, should thy people see me in mine accustomed state, they would flee, shrieking in terror.
Canst thou truly inspire such fear, gentle maiden?
He smiled. I cannot give credence to thy words. In truth, methinks, shouldst thou appear on the streets of fire-domed Mathurian, my subjects would indeed run, but not away from thee.
That thou must judge for thyself, Majesty.
Before we proceed, might I inquire as to the state of your Majesty's health?
Itania asked prudently.
I'm well, Itania. No shortness of breath? No heaviness or twinges in your Majesty's chest?
I said that I'm healthy, Itania, Sarabian snapped.
I certainly hope so, your Majesty. May I be permitted to present the Lady Zanisha, the Anarae of the Delphae?
I think your brother's right, Itania. I think you've taken leave of...
Good God!
Sarabian was staring in open horror at Zanisha. Like the dye running out of a bolt of cheap cloth, the color was draining from her skin and hair, and the incandescent glow that had marked her before she had disguised it began to shine forth again. She rose to her feet, and Calton stood up beside her.
Now is the stuff of thy nightmares made flesh, Sarabian of Tamale,
Zanisha said sadly.
This is who and what I am. Thy servant Itania hath told thee well and truly what transpired in fabled Delphaeus. I would greet thee in a manner suitable to thy station. But like all the Delphae, I am outcast, and therefore not subject to thee. I am here to perform those services which devolve upon my people by reason of our pact with Annika, whom thou hast called Sparhawk of Alenia. Fear me not, Sarabian, for I am here to serve, not to destroy.
Myrtai, her face deathly pale, had risen to her feet. Purposefully, she stepped in front of her mistress and drew her sword.
Run, Elana, she said grimly. I'll hold her back.
That is not needful, Myrtai of Aton, Zenisha told her. As I said, I mean no harm to any in this company. Sheathe thy sword.
I will, accursed one, in your vile heart.
Myrtai raised her sword. Then, as if struck by some great blow, she reeled back and fell to the floor, tumbling over and over. Kring and Angessa reacted immediately, rushing forward and clawing at their sword hilts.
I would not hurt them, Annika,
Zenisha warned Sparhawk.
But I must protect myself, that I may keep faith with the pact between thee and my people.
Put up your swords, Vanyan barked. The lady is a friend.
But,
Kring protested.
I said to put up your swords.
Vanyan's roar was shattering, and Kring and Angessa stopped in their tracks. Sparhawk, however, saw another danger. Danae, her eyes bleak and her face set, was advancing on the Delphaic woman.
Ah, there you are, Danae, he said,
moving rather more quickly than his casual tone might have suggested. He intercepted the vengeful little princess.
Aren't you going to give your poor old father a kiss?
He swept her up into his arms and smothered her indignant outburst by mashing his lips to hers.
Put me down, Sparhawk, she said,
speaking directly down his throat.
Not until you get a grip on your temper, he muttered, his mouth still clamped to hers.
She hurt Myrtai.
No, she didn't. Myrtai knows how to fall without getting hurt. Don't do anything foolish here. You knew this was going to happen. Everything's under control, so don't get excited. And don't, for God's sake, let your mother find out who you really are.
It doesn't really talk,
Elana interrupted Sparhawk's account of what had taken place in Delphaeus.
Not by itself, no, Sparhawk replied. It spoke through Calton. Well, it did the first time, anyway.
Calton?
I have no idea why. Maybe it just seizes on whoever's handy. The language it uses is archaic and formal. These and thous and that sort of thing. Its speech is much like Zanisha's, and it wants me to respond in kind. Evidently, the mode of speech is important.
He rubbed one hand across his freshly shaved cheek.
It's very strange, but as soon as I began to speak and think in 12th century Hellenic, something seemed to open in my mind. For the first time I knew that I was Annika, and I knew that Belium and I are linked together in some profoundly personal way.
He smiled wryly.
It seems that you're married to two different people, love. I hope you'll like Annika. He seems a decent enough sort, once you get used to the way he talks.
Perhaps I should just go mad, she said. That might be easier than trying to understand what's going on. How many other strangers do you plan to bring to my bed tonight?
Sparhawk looked at Vanyan.
Should I tell them about Sophronia? You might as well, Vanyan sighed. They'll find out about it soon enough anyway.
Sparhawk took his wife's hands in his and looked into her gray eyes.
You're going to have to be a little careful when you talk with Sophronia, dear, he told her.
There's an ancient enmity between the Delphae and the Styrix, and Sophronia grows irrational whenever she's around them. Zanisha has problems with the Styrix as well, but she manages to keep it under control better than Sophronia does.
Doth it seem so to thee, Annika?
Zanisha asked. She had resumed her disguise, more for the sake of the comfort of the others than out of any real need, Sparhawk guessed. Myrtai sat not far from her with watchful eyes,
and with her hand resting on her sword hilt. "I'm not trying to be personally offensive, Anna Ray," he apologized. "I'm just trying to explain the situation so that they'll understand when you and Sophrenia try to claw each other's eyes out."
"I'm sure you've noticed my husband's blinding charm, Anna Ray," Ilana smiled. "Sometimes he absolutely overwhelms us with it." Zanisha actually laughed, then looked at Itania. "These Alines are a complex people, are they not? I do detect great agility of thought behind this bluff manner of theirs, and subtleties I would not have expected from a people who tailor steel into garments."
Sparhawk leaned back in his chair. "I haven't really covered everything that happened, but that's enough to let you know in general what we encountered. We can fill in more detail tomorrow. What's been going on here?"
"Politics, of course,"
Ilana shrugged. "Don't you ever get tired of politics?"
"Don't be silly, Sparhawk. Milord Stragan, why don't you tell him? It shocks him when I start going into all the sordid details."
Stragan was once again dressed in his favorite white satin doublet. The blonde thief was sunk deep in a chair, with his feet up on a table.
"That attempted coup alerted us that there were more mundane elements involved in this business than hobgoblins and resurrected antiquities," he began. "We knew that Krager was involved, and Interior Minister Colada, and that turned it into ordinary garden-variety politics. We didn't know where Krager was, so we decided to find out just how deeply Interior was infected. Since all policemen everywhere are compulsive about paperwork, we were fairly sure that somewhere in that rabbit warren of a building was a set of files that would identify the people we wanted to talk with. The problem was that we couldn't just walk into the ministry and demand to see their files without giving away the fact that we knew what they were up to, which in turn would have let them know that Colada was our prisoner instead of a willing guest. Baroness Melodir came up with the idea of a new filing system, and that gave us access to all the files of all the ministries."
"It was dreadful," Oscania shuddered. "We had to disrupt the entire government in order to conceal the fact that we were really only interested in the files at Interior. Milord Stragan and the Baroness put their heads together and concocted a system. It's totally irrational and wildly inconsistent, but for some reason it works amazingly well. I can lay my hands on any given piece of paper in less than an hour."
"Anyway," Stragan continued, "we browsed through the files at Interior for a week or so, but the people over there kept slipping back into the building at night to move things around, so that we'd have to start all over again every morning. That's when we decided to just move our operations out onto the lawns. We stripped all the paper out of all the buildings and spread it out on the grass. That inconvenienced the rest of the government enormously, but Interior was still holding out on us. They were still hiding the critical files. Kaalador and I reverted to type and tried burglary, along with Mirtai. The Queen sent her along to remind us that we were looking for paper, rather than miscellaneous valuables, I guess. It took a few nights, but we finally found a hidden room where the files we wanted were concealed."
"Didn't they miss them the next morning?" Bevier asked him.
"We didn't take them, Sir Knight," Kaalador told him. "The Queen called in a young Pandian, who used a steric spell to bring the information back to the castle without physically removing the documents." He grinned.
"We got us all that there real incriminating stuff, and they don't know we got it. We stole it, and they don't even miss it."
"We've got the name of every spy, every informer, every secret policeman, and every conspirator of whatever rank Interior has in all of Tamale," Sarabian smirked. "We've been waiting for all of you to come home so that we can take steps. I'm going to dissolve the Ministry of the Interior, round up all those people, and declare martial law. Betwana and I have been in close contact, and we've laid our plans very carefully. As soon as I give the word, the Etons are going to take charge of the entire empire. Then I'll really be the emperor, instead of just a stuffed toy."
"You've all been very busy," Vanyan observed.
"It makes the time go faster, my lord," Kaalador shrugged. "We went a little farther, though. Krager obviously knew that we were using the criminals of Mytherion as spies.
but we weren't sure if he knew about the hidden government. If he thinks our organization's localized, that's not much of a problem. But if he knows that I can give the order here in Matherian, and somebody dies in Kyrellos, that's a whole nother thing. I've missed that dialect, Talon said. He considered it. Not really very much, though, he added. Critic, Kaalador accused.
How much were you able to find out?
Ulof asked him. Kaalador spread one hand and rocked it back and forth dubiously. It's sort of hard to say, he admitted. They some places where it is them folks ourn can move around free as frogs in a muddy pond. Other places they can't. He made a sour face. It probably all boils down to natural talent. Some are gifted, some aren't. We've made a little headway in putting names to some of the rabid nationalists in various parts of Tomalley. At least we think it's headway. If Krager really knows what we're doing, he could be feeding us false information. We wanted to wait until you came back before we tested the information we've got.
How do you test something like that? Bevier asked.
We'll send out the order to have somebody's throat cut, then see if they try to protect him, Strachan replied. Some chief of police somewhere, or maybe one of those nationalist leaders. Elrond, maybe. Isn't that astonishing, Sparhawk? That's one of the things we found out. It turns out that Elrond is the mysterious Saber.
What an amazing thing, Sparhawk replied with feigned astonishment.
Kaalador wants to kill the man named Scarpa, Strachan went on. But I favor Elrond, although my preference in the matter could be viewed as a form of literary criticism. Elrond deserves killing more for his abominable verse than his political opinions.
The world can stand a little more bad poetry, Strachan, Kaalador told his friend. Scarpa's the really dangerous one. I just wish we could put a name to Rebal, but so far he's eluded us. His real name's Amador, Talon told him. He's a ribbon clerk in Jorson, on the west coast of Edom.
How did you find that out?
Kaalador seemed astonished. Pure luck, to be honest about it. We saw Rebal making a speech to some peasants out in the woods. Then, later on, when we were in Jorson, a gust of wind blew me into his shop. He isn't really very much to worry about. He's a charlatan. He uses carnival tricks to make the peasants think that he's raising the ghost of Incites. Sophrenia seems to think that means that our enemies are spread thin. They don't have enough real magicians to arrange all these visitations, so they have to resort to trickery.
What were you doing in Edom, Sparhawk? Ilana asked.
We went through there on our way to pick up Belian.
How did you get there and back so fast?
Afriel helped us. She's very helpful. Most of the time.
Sparhawk avoided looking at his daughter. He rose to his feet.
We're all a little tired tonight, he suggested. And I rather expect that filling in all of the details is going to take us quite a while. Why don't we break off here and get some sleep? Then we'll be able to attack it again in the morning when we're all fresh.
Good idea, Ilana agreed, also rising. Besides, I've got this burning curiosity.
Oh?
As long as I'm going to be sleeping with him, I should probably get to know this Annika fellow, wouldn't you say? Sleeping with total strangers so tarnishes a girl's reputation, you know.
She's still asleep, Danae said, quietly closing the door to Sophrenia's room.
Is she all right? Sparhawk asked.
Of course she isn't. What did you expect, Sparhawk? Her heart's broken.
Come with me. We need to talk.
I don't think I want to talk with you right now, Father. I'm just a little unhappy with you.
I can live with that.
Don't be too sure.
Come along.
He took her by the hand and led her up a long flight of stairs to the top of the tower, and then out onto the parapet. He prudently closed the door and bolted it behind them.
You blundered, Afriel, he told her.
She raised her chin and gave him a flat, icy stare.
Don't get imperial with me, young lady. You made a mistake. You never should have let Sophrenia go to Delphaeus.
She had to go. She has to go through this.
She can't. It's more than she can bear.
She's stronger than she looks.
Don't you have any heart at all? Can't you see how much she's suffering?
Of course I can. And it's hurting me far more than it's hurting you, Father.
You're killing Vanyan, too, you know.
He's also stronger than he looks. Why did all of you turn against Sophronia at Delphaeus? Two or three soft words from Zanisha was all it took to make you throw away 300 years of love and devotion. Is that the way you Alenes customarily treat your friends?
She's the one who forced the issue, Afriel. She started delivering ultimatums.
I don't think you realize how strongly she feels about the Delphae. She was totally irrational.
What's behind all of that?
That's none of your business.
I think it is. What really happened during the Sirgai Wars?
I won't tell you. Art thou afeard to speak of it, goddess?
Sparhawk spun around quickly, a startled oath coming to his lips. It was Zanisha. She stood all aglow, not far from where they were talking.
This doesn't concern you, Zanisha,
Afriel told her coldly.
I must needs know thine heart, goddess. Thy sister's enmity is of no real moment. Thine, however, would be more troublesome. Art thou also unkindly disposed toward me?
Why don't you leech my thoughts and find out for yourself?
Thou knowest that I cannot, Afriel. Thy mind is closed to me.
I'm so glad you noticed that.
Behave yourself, Sparhawk told his daughter, speaking very firmly.
Stay out of this, Sparhawk.
No, Danae, I don't think I will. Are you behind the way Sophronia was behaving at Delphaeus?
Don't be absurd. I sent her to Delphaeus to cure her of that nonsense.
Are you sure, Afriel? You're not behaving very well at the moment yourself, you know.
I don't like Eudemus, and I don't like his people. I'm trying to cure Sophronia out of love for her, not out of any affection for the Delphae.
But thou didst stand for us against thy kindred when all this began, goddess,
Zanisha pointed out.
That also was not out of any great affection for your race, Zanisha. My family was wrong, and I opposed them out of principle. You wouldn't understand that, though, would you? It had to do with love, and you Delphae have outgrown that, haven't you?
How little thou knowest us, goddess,
Zanisha said sadly.
As long as we're all speaking so frankly, I've noticed a certain bias against Styrix in some of your remarks, Anaray, Sparhawk said pointedly.
I have reasons, Annika. Many reasons.
I'm sure you have, and I'm sure Sophronia has reasons too. But whether we like each other or not is really beside the point. I am going to straighten this all out. I've got work to do, and I can't do it in the middle of a catfight. I will make peace among you, even if I have to use the Bellium to do it.
Sparhawk!
Danae's face was shocked.
Nobody wants to tell me what really happened during the Sirgai Wars, and maybe that's just as well. I was curious at first, but not any longer. What it boils down to, ladies, is that I don't care what happened. The way you've all been behaving sort of says that nobody's hands were really clean. I want this spiteful wrangling to stop. You're all behaving like children, and it's beginning to make me tired.
Chapter 17. There were dark circles under Sophronia's eyes the next morning, and the light had gone out of her face. Her white styric robe was partially covered by a sleeveless overmantle of deepest black. Sparhawk had never seen her wear that kind of garment before, and her choice, of both the garment and the color, seemed ominous. She joined them at the breakfast table reluctantly, and only at Aelana's express command. She sat slightly apart from the rest of them, with her injury drawn about her like a defensive wall. She would not look at Vanyan, and refused breakfast, despite Aelene's urgings. Vanyan appeared no less injured. His face was drawn and pale, quite nearly as pale as it had been when he had been carrying the burden of the swords, and his eyes were filled with pain. Breakfast under those circumstances was strained, and they all left the table with a certain relief. They proceeded directly to the blue-draped sitting room and got down to business. "The others aren't really all that significant," Kaalador told them. "Ribal, Saber, and Baron Perak are decidedly second-rate. All they're really doing is exploiting existing hostilities. Skarpa's something quite different, though. Arjuna's a troublesome sort of place to begin with, and Skarpa's using that to the fullest. The others have to be fairly circumspect, because the Aline kingdoms of Western Tamale are so well populated. There are people everywhere, so the conspirators have to sneak around. Southeastern Arjuna's one vast jungle, though, so Skarpa's got places to hide, and places he can defend. He makes some small pretense at nationalism, in the way that the others do, but that doesn't appear to be his main agenda. The Arjunai are far more shrewd than the Aline peasants and serfs of the West."
"Have you got any background on him?"
Ulof asked.
"Where he came from, what he did before he set up shop, that sort of thing?"
Kaalador nodded. "That part wasn't very difficult. Skarpa was fairly well known in some circles before he joined the conspiracy." Kaalador made a face. "I wish there were some other word. Conspiracy sounds so melodramatic." He shrugged. "Anyway, Scarpa's a bastard."
"Kaalador,"
Thevier said sharply,
"there are ladies present."
"It wasn't intended as an obscenity, Sir Bevier, merely as a legal definition. Scarpa's the result of a dalliance between a militantly promiscuous Arjunai tavern wench and a renegade steric. It was an odd sort of pairing off, and it produced a very odd sort of fellow."
"Don't pursue this too far, Kaalador," Stragan said ominously.
"Grow up, Stragan. You're not the only one with irregular parentage. When you get right down to it, I'm not entirely sure who my father was either. Bastardy's no great inconvenience for a man with brains and talent."
"My Lord Stragan's oversensitive about his origins,"
Baroness Melodir explained lightly.
"I've spoken with him time and again about it, but he still has feelings of inadequacy. It might not be a bad thing, though. He's so generally stupendous otherwise that a little bit of insecurity keeps him from being unbearable."
Stragan rose and bowed flamboyantly.
"Oh, sit down, Stragan," she said.
"Where was I?" Kaalador said. "Oh, yes, now I recollect. This year, Skarpa feller, he growed up in a shack-nasty sort of roadside tavern down thar in Arjuna, and he'd done all the sort of things which it is as bastards does in their formative years in a place thout no real moral restraints on 'em." "Please, Kaalador," Stragan sighed.
"Just entertaining the queen, old boy." Kaalador shrugged. "She pines away without periodic doses of down-home folksiness."
"What does shack-nasty mean, Kaalador?"
Ilana interrupted him.
"Why, just what it says, your queenship. A shack's a kind of fowed-together hovel built out in old boards and scraps. And nasty means pretty much what it says. I knowed a feller as went by that name when I was a pup. He lived in the messiest place you ever did see. And he warn't none too clean his own self, neither."
"I think I can survive for several hours now without any more mangled language, Master Kaalador," she smiled. "I want to thank you for your concern, though."
"Always glad to be of service, Your Majesty," he grinned. Skarpa grew up in a situation that sort of skirted the edges of crime. He was what you might call a gifted amateur. He never really settled down into one given trade. He made a face.
"Dabblers. I absolutely detest dabblers.
Anyway, he pandered for his mother, just as every good boy should, and also for his numerous half-sisters, who, if we're to believe the common gossip, were all whores from the cradle. He was a moderately competent pickpocket and cutpurse, and a fairly gifted swindler. Unlike many of his mother's one-time paramours, Scarpa's steric father stayed around for a time, and he used to drop back to visit his son from time to time. So Skarpa got a smattering of a steric education. Eventually, however,
he made the kind of mistake we expect amateurs to make. He tried to cut the purse of a tavern patron who wasn't quite as drunk as he appeared to be. His intended victim grabbed him, and Scarpa demonstrated the Arjunai side of his nature. He whipped out a small, very sharp knife, and spilled the fellow's guts out on the floor of the tavern. Some busybody went to the police about it, and Scarpa left home rather abruptly. Wise move, Talon murmured. Didn't he get any professional training while he was growing up? No, he appears to have picked things up on his own. Precocious. Calador nodded his agreement. If he'd had the right teachers, he probably could have become a master thief. After he ran away, he seems to have kept moving for a couple of years. He was only 12 or so when he killed that first man, and when he was about 14, he turned up in a traveling carnival. He billed himself as a magician, the usual sort of carnival fakery, although he occasionally utilized a few steric spells to perform real magic. He grew a beard, which is very unusual among the Tamil races, since Tamil men don't have much facial hair. Neither do Styrics, for that matter, now that I think about it. Scarpa's a half-breed, and the mixture of Southern Tamil and Styric came out rather peculiarly. Neither his features nor some of his traits are really characteristic of either race. Calador reached inside his doublet and drew out a folded sheet of paper. Here, he said, opening the paper. Judge for yourselves. The drawing was a bit crude, more a caricature than a portrait. It was a depiction of a man with a strangely compelling face. The eyes were deep sunk under heavy brows. The cheekbones were high and prominent. The nose aquiline, and the mouth sensual. The beard appeared to be dense and black, and it was meticulously trimmed and shaped.
He spends a lot of time on that beard, Calton observed. It looks as if he shaves off stray whiskers hair by hair.
He frowned slightly.
He looks familiar for some reason.
Something around the eyes, I think. I'm surprised you can even recognize the fact that it's supposed to be a picture of a human being, Talon sniffed. The technique's absolutely awful. The girl hasn't had any training, Talon, Calador defended the artist. She's gifted in her own profession, though.
Which profession is that, Master Calador? Elana asked.
She's a whore, Your Majesty. He shrugged. The drawing is just a sideline. She likes to keep pictures of her customers. She studies their faces during the course of her business transactions, and some of the portraits have strange expressions.
May I see that?
Sophrenia asked suddenly. Of course, Lady Sophrenia. Calador looked a little surprised as he took the drawing to her. Then he returned to his seat. Did you ever meet Jukta, Sparhawk? He asked.
Once.
Now there's a beard for you. Jukta looks like an ambulatory shrub. He's even got whiskers on his eyelids. Anyhow, Scarpa traveled with the carnival for several seasons. Then, about 5 years back, he dropped out of sight for a year or so. When he returned, he went into politics, if that's what you want to call it. He makes some small pretense at nationalism in the same way that Rebal, Perak, and Saber do. But that's only for the benefit of the truly ignorant down in Arjuna. The national hero there was the man who established the slave trade, a fellow named Shugwan. That's a fairly contemptible sort of thing, so not many Arjunais take much pride in it.
They still practice it, though, Mirtai said bleakly.
They do indeed, little Dorlan.
Calador agreed.
Friend Calador, Kring said, I thought we agreed that you weren't going to call Mirtai that anymore. Oh, it don't mean nothing, Kring. It's just my folksy way of setting people at their ease.
He paused. Where was I? He asked.
You were starting to get to the point, Stragan replied.
Testy this morning, aren't we, old boy? Calador said mildly. From what our people were able to discover, Scarpa's far more dangerous than those three enthusiasts in Western Tamale. Arjunai thieves are more devious than run-of-the-mill criminals, and a number of them have infiltrated Scarpa's apparatus for fun and profit.
The Arjunai are an untrustworthy people, so the Empire's been obliged to deal with them quite firmly. Arjunai hatred for the Tamils is very real, so Scarpa hasn't had to stir it up artificially. Kahalador tugged at his nose a bit dubiously. I'm not altogether sure how much of this we can believe, the Arjunai being what they are and all, but one highway robber down there claims to have been a member of Scarpa's inner circle for a while. He told us that our man's just a little deranged. He operates out of the ruins of Natayos, down in the southern jungles. The town was destroyed during the Etan invasion back in the 17th century, and Scarpa doesn't so much hide there as he does occupy the place, in a military sense of the word. He's reinforced the crumbling old walls so that the town's defensible. Our highwayman reports that Scarpa starts raving sometimes. If we can believe our informant, he started talking about the Sirgai once, and about Sirgon. He tells his cronies that Sirgon wants to make his people the masters of the world, but that the Sirgai, with that institutionalized stupidity of theirs, aren't really intelligent enough to govern a global empire. Scarpa doesn't have any problems with the idea of an empire. He just doesn't like the way the present one's set up. He'd be more happy with it if there were just a few changes. Up at the top. He believes that the Sirgai will conquer the world, and then retreat back into their splendid isolation. Somebody's going to have to run the government of the world for them, and Scarpa's got a candidate in mind for the position.
That's insane, Vivier exclaimed.
I think I already suggested that, Sir Knight. Scarpa seems to think he'd make a very good emperor.
The position's already been filled, Sarabia noted dryly.
Scarpa's hoping that Sirgon will vacate it, Your Majesty. He tells his people that the Sirgai have absolutely no administrative skills, and that they're going to need someone to run the conquered territories for them. He'll volunteer at that point. He'll genuflect perfunctorily in Sirgon's direction once in a while, and more or less run things to suit himself. He has large dreams. I'll give him that.
It has a sort of familiar ring to it, doesn't it, Sparhawk? Calton said with a tight grin. Didn't Martell and Anias have the same sort of notion?
Oh, my goodness, yes, Elana agreed. I feel as if I've lived through all of this before.
Where does Krager fit in? Sparhawk asked.
Krager seems to be some sort of coordinator,
Kahalador replied.
He serves as a go-between.
He travels a great deal, carrying messages and instructions.
We're guessing about this, but we think that there's a layer of command between Sirgon and the people like Scarpa, Perak, Lebal, and Saber. Krager's known to all of them, and that authenticates his messages. He seems to have found his natural niche in life. Queen Elana tells us that he served Martell and Anias in exactly the same way. And he was doing the same kind of thing back in Eosia when he was carrying out Count Garrick's instructions to those bandits in the mountains east of Cardos.
We should really make some sort of effort to scoop Krager up,
Uloth rumbled.
He starts talking if someone so much as gives him a harsh look, and he knows a great deal about things that make me moderately curious.
That's how he's managed to stay alive for so long, Calton grunted.
He always makes sure that he's got so much valuable information that we don't dare kill him.
Kill him after he talks, Sir Calton,
Khalad said.
He makes us promise not to.
So?
We're knights, Khalad, Calton explained. Once we give someone our oath, we're obliged to keep our word.
You weren't thinking of knighting me at any time in the immediate future, were you, Lord Vanyan?
Khalad asked.
It might be just a little premature, Khalad.
That means that I'm still a peasant, doesn't it?
Well, technically maybe.
That solves the problem, then,
Khalad said with a chill little smile.
Go ahead and catch him, Sir Calton. Promise him anything you have to in order to get him to talk. Then turn him over to me. Nobody expects a peasant to keep his word.
I'm going to like this young man, Sparhawk.
Calton grinned.
Zelast is coming for me, Sparhawk,
Sophronia told the big Pandian.
he'll escort me safely back to Sarsos.
She shook her head, refusing to enter the room to which they were returning after lunch.
You're being childish. You know that, don't you, Sophronia?
I've outlived my usefulness, and I've been around Aline's long enough to know what a prudent styric does when that happens. As long as a styric's useful, she's relatively safe among Aline's. Once she's served her purpose, though, her presence starts to be embarrassing, and you Aline's deal abruptly with inconvenient people. I'd rather not have one of you slip a knife between my ribs.
Are you just about finished? Conversations like this bore me. We love you, Sophronia, and it has nothing to do with whether or not you're useful to us. You're breaking Vanyan's heart. You know that, too, don't you?
So? He broke mine, didn't he? Take your problems to Zanisha, since you're all enamored of her.
That's beneath you, little mother.
Her chin came up.
I think I'd rather you didn't call me that anymore, Sparhawk. It's just a bit grotesque in the present circumstances. I'll be in my room, if it's still mine. If it isn't, I'll go live in the Styric community here in Mytherian. If it's not too much trouble, let me know when Zalasta arrives.
And she turned and walked down the corridor, ostentatiously wearing her injury like a garment. Sparhawk swore under his breath. Then he saw Colton and Aline coming down the tiled hallway. At least that particular problem had been resolved. The Queen's maid had laughed in Colton's face when the blonde knight had clumsily offered to step aside so that she could devote her attentions to Barret. She had then, Sparhawk gathered, convinced Colton that her affections were still quite firmly where they were supposed to be.
"But you never leave her side, Sir Colton," the doe-eyed girl accused. "You're always hovering over her, and making certain that she has everything she needs or wants."
"It's a duty, Aline," Colton tried to explain. "I'm not doing it because I have any kind of affection for her."
"You're performing your duty just a little too well to suit me, Sir Knight." Aline's voice, that marvelous instrument, conveyed a whole range of feelings. The girl could speak volumes with only the slightest change of key and intonation.
"Oh, God," Sparhawk groaned. Why did he always have to get caught in these personal matters? This time, however, he moved quickly to put a stop to things before they got out of hand. He stepped out into the corridor to confront the pair of them. "Why don't we take care of this right now?" he suggested bluntly.
"Take care of what?" Colton demanded.
"This isn't any of your business, Sparhawk."
"I'm making it my business. Are you satisfied that Aline doesn't have any kind of serious feelings for Barret?"
Colton and the girl exchanged a quick, guilty sort of glance.
"Good," Sparhawk said. "My congratulations to you both. Now let's clear up this Zanisha business."
"Colton was telling you the truth, Aline, as far as he went. His duty obliges him to stay close to her, because he's required to make certain that no harm comes to her. We have an agreement with her people, and she's here as our hostage to make sure that they don't go back on their word. We all know that if the Delphi betray us in any way, Colton will kill Zanisha. That's why he's staying so close to her."
"Kill?"
The girl's huge eyes went even wider.
"Those are the rules, Aline," Colton shrugged. "I don't like them very much, but I have to follow them."
"You wouldn't?"
"Only if I have to, and I wouldn't like it very much. That's what the word hostage means, though. I always seem to be the one who gets these dirty jobs."
"How could you?" Aline said to Sparhawk. "How could you do this to your oldest friend?"
"Military decisions are hard sometimes," Sparhawk told her. "Are you satisfied now that Colton's not straying? You do know, don't you, that when he thought that you'd fallen in love with Barret, he started going out of his way trying to get himself killed?" "You didn't have to tell her that, Sparhawk," Colton protested.
"You idiot!"
Aline's voice climbed effortlessly into the upper ranges. She spoke, at length, to Sparhawk's friend,
while he stood hanging his head and scuffing his feet like a schoolboy being scolded. Sparhawk ventured, why don't the two of you go someplace private where you can discuss things?
With your leave, Prince Sparhawk, Aileen agreed with an abrupt little curtsy. You, she snapped to Calton, come with me.
Yes, dear, Calton said submissively, and the two went on back up the corridor.
Was that Aileen just now?
Baroness Melodyr asked, sticking her head out through the doorway. Yes, Sparhawk replied.
Where are she and Calton going?
She asked, looking after the pair. They have something important to take care of.
Something more important than what we're discussing in here?
They seem to think so, Baroness. We can manage without them this afternoon, I expect. And it's a matter that needs clearing up.
Oh, she said. One of those.
I'm afraid so.
Aileen will straighten it out,
Melodyr said confidently. I'm sure she will. How's your campaign going, Baroness? I'm not trying to pry, you understand. It's just that these matters break my concentration, and I kind of like to have them out of the way so they don't come bubbling to the surface when I least expect them to.
Everything's on schedule, Prince Sparhawk.
Good. Have you told him?
Of course not. He doesn't need to know yet. I'll break it to him gently when the time comes. It's actually kinder that way. If he finds out too soon, he'll just worry about it. Trust me, Your Highness. I know exactly what I'm doing.
There's something I'd sort of like to get cleared up before we go on, Anaray, Stragan said to Zanisha. The Tommels all believe that the Seergai were extinct, but Krager and Scarpa say otherwise.
The Seergai want the world to believe that they are no more, she replied. After their disastrous march on Sarsos, they returned home and concentrated for a time on replenishing their subordinate forces, the Seneskans, which forces had been virtually annihilated by the Styrix.
So we've heard, Kaalador said. We were told that the Seergai concentrated with such single-mindedness that their own women were past childbearing age before they realized their mistake.
Thine informant spoke truly, Master Kaalador, and it is the common belief in Tamale that the Seer Grace died out some 10 eons ago. That common belief, however, is in error. It is a belief which ignores the fact that Seergon is a god. He did not, however, take the blind obedience of his people into account when he commanded them to devote their attentions to the women of the Seneskans. But when he saw that his chosen race was dying out, he did alter the natural course of such things, and aged Seergai women became fertile once more, though most died in childbirth. Thus were the Seergai perpetuated.
Pity, Oscania murmured.
Knowing, however, that the diminished numbers of his worshippers and the Styric curse which imprisoned them in their arid homeland did imperil them, Seergon sought to protect his people. The Seneskans were commanded to confirm and perpetuate the belief of the other races of Tamale that the Seergai were no more, and the dread city of Seerga itself was concealed from the eyes of men.
In the same way that Delphaeus is concealed? Fenian guessed.
Nay, my lord, we are more subtle than Seergon. We conceal Delphaeus by misdirection. Seergon hides Seerga in the central highlands of Seneska by means of an enchantment. Thou couldst go to those highlands and ride close by Seerga and never see it.
An invisible city? Talon asked her incredulously.
The Seergai can see it,
she replied.
And when it doth suit them so, their Seneskan underlings can as well. To all others, however, Seerga is not there.
The tactical advantages of that must be enormous, Bevier noted in his most professional tone.
The Seergai have an absolutely secure stronghold
into which they can retreat if things go wrong.
Their advantage is offset, however,
Zanisha pointed out.
They may freely ravage and despoil Seneska, which is theirs already, and which is no more than a barren waste at best. But they may not pass the boundaries of their homeland. The curse of the Styrix is still potent, I do assure thee. It is the wont of the kings of the Seergai to periodically test that curse. Aged warriors are taken from time to time to the boundary and commanded to attempt a crossing. They die in mid-stride as they obediently march across the line.
Sarabian was looking at her, his eyes narrowed shrewdly. Prithee, Enere, advise me in this matter. Thou hast said that the Seneskans are subject to the Seergai?
Yes, Majesty.
All Seneskans?
Those in authority, Imperial Sarabian.
The king, the government, the army? She nodded.
And their ambassadors as well?
Oscania added.
Very good, Oscania,
Itania murmured to his brother.
Very, very good.
I didn't quite follow that.
Ulath admitted.
I did, Stragan told him. We'd probably better look into that, Kalidor.
I'll see to it.
Do you know what they're talking about, friend Engessa?
Kring asked. It's not all that complicated, Kring, Elana explained. The Seneskan embassy here in Mithyrian is full of people who take their orders from the Seergai. I'd guess that if we were to look into the matter, we'd find that the headquarters of the recent attempt to overthrow the Emperor was located in that embassy.
And if he's not out of town, we might even find Krager there as well,
Khalad mused.
Talon, how long would it take you to teach me how to be a burglar?
What have you got in mind? Sparhawk asked his squire.
I thought I might creep into that embassy and steal Krager, my lord. Since Anaray Zanisha can tell us what he's thinking, we wouldn't even have to break his fingers to make him talk, or make him any inconvenient promises that we probably didn't intend to keep anyway.
I sense thy discontent, Annika,
Zanisha said later, when she, Sparhawk, and Danae had returned to the fortified roof of the central tower of Aelana's castle.
I've been had, Anaray, he said sourly.
I do not recognize the expression.
He means that he's been duped, Danae translated, and he's being impolite enough to imply that I have too. She gave her father a smug little smile. I told you so, Sparhawk.
Spare me, please.
Oh, no, father. I've got this wonderful chance to gloat. You're not going to rob me of it. If I remember correctly, and I do, I was against the idea of retrieving Belium from the very beginning. I knew that it was a mistake, but you bullied me into agreeing.
He ignored that. Was any of it real? The troll gods, Drichtnoth, the monsters? Or was it all just some elaborate game designed to get me to bring Belium to Tomali?
Some of it may have been real, Sparhawk, she replied. But you've probably put your finger on the actual reason behind it all.
It is thy belief that Sirgon deceiveth thee into bringing Belium within his reach, Annika?
Zanisha said.
Why bother to ask, Anaray? You know what I'm thinking already. Sirgon believes that he could use Belium to break that curse, so that his people could start invading their neighbors again.
I told you so,
Danae reminded him again.
Please.
He looked out over the glowing city.
I think I need a divine opinion here, he said. Up until very recently, we all believed that Belium was just a thing. Powerful, but just an object. We know that's not true now. Belium has its own personality and its own will. It's more of an ally than just a weapon. Not only that, and please don't be offended, Afriel, in some ways it's even more powerful than the gods of this world.
I am offended, Sparhawk, she said tartly. Besides, I haven't finished telling you that I told you so. He laughed, swept her up into his arms, and kissed her.
I love you, he told her, still laughing.
Isn't he a nice boy?
Danae said to Zanisha. The Delphic woman smiled.
If we didn't know about Belium's awareness and its will, could Sirgon have known? I don't think Azash did. Speaking as a goddess, would you want to pick up something that could make its own decisions and might just decide that it didn't like you all that much?
I wouldn't, she replied. Sirgon might be a different matter, though. He's so arrogant that he might believe that he could control Belium even against its will.
But he couldn't, could he? Azash thought he could control Belium by sheer force. He wasn't even interested in the rings. The rings can compel Belium, because they're a part of it. Could Sirgon be as stupid as Azash was?
Sparhawk, you're talking about one of my distant relatives. Please be a little more respectful. Danae's brow furrowed with thought. She absently kissed her father.
Don't do that, he said. This is serious.
I know. It helps me to think. Belium's never made itself known before. You're probably right, Sparhawk. Azash wasn't really very bright. Sirgon has the same sort of personality, and he's made several blunders in the past. That's one of the drawbacks of divinity. We don't have to be intelligent. We all know about Belium's power, but I don't think any of us have ever come to grips with the notion of its will before. Did it really talk to Sparhawk the way he said it did, Zanisha? As an equal, I mean?
As at least an equal, goddess,
Zanisha replied.
Belium and Annika are allies, not friends, and neither is master.
Where are we going with this, Sparhawk? Danae asked.
I'm not sure. Sirgon may have made another of those blunders, though. He may just have tricked me into bringing back the one thing that could defeat him. I think we may have an advantage here, but we should probably give a great deal of thought to just exactly how we're going to use it.
You're hateful, Sparhawk, Danae said.
I beg your pardon?
You've just taken all the fun out of all the I-told-you-sos I've been saving up.
Zelasta arrived in Mytherian 2 days later. After only the briefest of greetings to the rest of them, he went immediately to Sophronia's room.
He'll straighten it out, Vanyan, Sparhawk assured the preceptor. He's her oldest friend, and he's far too wise to be infected with irrational prejudice.
I wouldn't be all that sure, Sparhawk.
Vanyan's face was gloomy.
I thought she was too wise. And look what happened. This blind hatred may infect the entire Styric race. If Zelasta feels the same way Sophronia does, all he's going to do is reinforce her prejudices.
Sparhawk shook his head.
No, my friend, Zelasta's above that. He has no reason to trust Aline's either, but he was willing to help us, wasn't he? He's a realist, and even if he does share her feelings, he'll suppress them in the name of political expediency. And if I'm right, he'll persuade her to do the same. She doesn't have to like Zanisha. All she has to do is accept the fact that we need her. Once Zelasta convinces her of that, the two of you will be able to patch things up.
Maybe.
It was several hours later when Zelasta emerged alone from Sophronia's room, with his rough-hewn Styric face somber.
It will not be easy, Prince Sparhawk, he said, when the two of them met in the corridor outside. She is deeply wounded. I cannot understand what Afriel was thinking of. Who can ever understand why Afriel does things, learned one?
Sparhawk smiled briefly.
She's the most whimsical and exasperating person I've ever known. As I understand it, she doesn't approve of Sophronia's prejudice, and she's taking steps. The expression, doing something to somebody for his own good, always implies a certain amount of brutality, I'm afraid. Were you able to talk any sense into Sophronia at all?
I'm approaching the question obliquely, Your Highness, Zelasta replied. Sophronia has already been deeply injured. This isn't a good time for a direct confrontation. I was at least able to persuade her to postpone her return to Sarsos.
That's something, anyway. Let's go talk to the others. A lot has happened since you left. The reports come from unimpeachable sources, Anare, Zelasta said coolly.
I do assure thee, Zelasta of Styricum, they are nonetheless false. None of the Delphae have left our valley for well over 100 years, except to deliver our invitation to Annika.
It's happened before, Zelasta, Calton told the white-robed Styric. We watched Rebal use some very obvious trickery when he was talking to a group of Edomish peasants.
Oh?
It was the sort of thing one sees in second-rate carnivals, learned one, Talon explained. One of his henchmen threw something into a fire. There was a flash of light and a puff of smoke. Then somebody dressed in old-time clothes stood up from where he'd been hiding and started bellowing in an ancient form of speech. The peasants all thought they were seeing Insides rising from the grave.
Those who witnessed the Shining Ones were not so gullible, Master Talon, Zelasta objected.
And the fellow who gulled them probably wasn't as clumsy. The boy shrugged. A skilled fake can make almost anybody believe almost anything, as long as they aren't close enough to see the hidden wires. Sophrenia told us that it means that the other side's a little short on real magicians, so they have to cheat.
Zelasta frowned. It may be possible, he conceded. The sightings were brief, and at quite some distance.
He looked at Zanisha.
You are certain, Anare? Could there perhaps be some of your people who live separately, who are cut off from Delphaeus and may have joined with our enemies?
They would no longer be of the Delphae, Zelasta of Styricum. We are bound to the lake. It is the lake which doth make us what we are. And I tell thee truly, the light which doth illuminate us is but the least of the things which do make us unlike all others.
She looked at him gravely.
Thou art Styric, Zelasta of Ilara, and thou art well aware of the consequences of markedly differing from thy neighbors.
Yes, he agreed, to our sorrow.
The decision of thy race to attempt to coexist with the other races of man may be suitable for Styrics,
she continued.
For my race, however, it hath not been possible. Ye of the Styric race are oft met with contempt and derision, but thy differences are not threatening to the Alenes or Tamils who are about you. We of Delphaeus, however, do inspire terror in the hearts of all others. In time, methinks, thy race will become acceptable. The wind of change hath already begun to blow, engendered in large measure by that fortuitous alliance betwixt ye and the Church of Kyrellos. The knights of that church are kindly disposed toward Styricum, and their might shall alter Alenic predispositions. For the Delphae, however, such accommodation is impossible. Our very appearance doth set us forever apart from all others, and this doth stand at the heart of our present alliance. We have sought out Annika, and we have offered him our aid in his struggle with Sirgon. In exchange, we have besought him only to raise up Belium, and to seal us away from all other men. Then none may come against us, nor may we go against any other. Thus we'll all be safe.
A wise decision, perhaps, Anare, Zelasta conceded. It was a choice which we considered in eons past. Delphaic numbers are limited, however, and your hidden valley will easily hold all of you. We Styrics are more numerous and more widespread. Our neighbors would not look kindly on a Styric homeland abutting their own borders. We cannot follow your course, but must live in the world.
Zanisha rose to her feet, putting one hand on Calton's shoulder.
Stay, gentle knight, she told him. I must confer a moment with Annika in furtherance of our pact. Should he detect falsity in me, he may slay me.
Sparhawk stood up, crossed to the door, and opened it for her. Denny, dragging Rollo behind her, followed them from the room.
What is it, Anare? Sparhawk asked.
Let us repair to that place above, where we are wont to speak,
she replied.
What I must tell thee is for thine ears alone.
Danae gave her a hard look.
Thou mayest also hear my words, Highness,
Zanisha told the little girl.
You're so kind.
We couldn't hide from her anyway, Zanisha, Sparhawk said. We could go to the top of the highest tower in Mytherian, and she'd fly up to eavesdrop on us anyway.
Canst thou truly fly, Highness?
Zanisha looked startled.
Can't everyone?
Behave yourself, Sparhawk told his daughter. They climbed the stairs to the top of the tower again, and went out onto the roof.
Annika, I must tell thee a truth, which thou mayest not wish to believe,
Zanisha said gravely.
But it is truth, nonetheless.
That's an unpromising start, Danae observed.
I must speak this truth, Annika,
Zanisha said gravely.
For it is not only in keeping with our pact, but it doth also have a grave import on our common design.
I get the feeling that I should take hold of something solid, Sparhawk said wryly.
As it seemeth best to thee, Annika. I must advise thee, however, that thy trust in Zelasta of Styricum is sorely misplaced.
What?
He hath played thee false, Annika. His heart and his mind are Sirgon's.
Chapter 18.
That's absolutely impossible, Danae exclaimed. Zelasta loves my sister and me. He'd never betray us.
He doth love thy sister beyond measure, goddess,
Zanisha replied.
His feelings for thee, however, are not so kindly. In truth, he doth hate thee.
I don't believe you.
Sparhawk was a soldier, and soldiers who cannot adjust to surprises rapidly do not live long enough to become veterans. You weren't at Delphaeus, Aphriel, he reminded the child goddess. Belium vouched for Zanisha's truthfulness.
She's just saying this to drive a wedge between us and Zelasta.
I don't really think so. A number of things were rapidly falling into place in Sparhawk's mind. The alliance is too important to the Delphae for her to endanger it with something that petty. And what she just told us explains several things that didn't make sense before. Let's hear her out. If there's some question about Zelasta's loyalty, we'd better find out about it right now. Exactly what did you discover in his mind, Anare?
A great confusion, Annika,
Zanisha said sadly.
The mind of Zelasta might have been a noble one, but it doth stand on the brink of madness, consumed with but one thought and one desire. He hath loved thy sister since earliest childhood, goddess, but his love is not the brotherly affection thou hast believed it was. This I know with greater certainty than all else, for it is ever at the forefront of his mind. He doth think of her as his affianced bride.
That's absurd, Danae said. She doesn't think of him that way at all.
Nay, but he doth think so of her. My sojourn within his thought was brief, therefore I do not as yet know all. As soon as I did perceive his treachery, my pledge bound me to reveal it to Annika. With more time, I will discover more.
What prompted you to look into his thought, Zanisha? Sparhawk asked her. The room was full of people. Why choose him? Or do you just listen to everybody simultaneously? It seems to me that would be very confusing. He made a face. I think I'm going at this backward. It might be helpful if I knew how your gift works. Is it like having another set of ears? Do you hear every thought going on around you, all at the same time?
Nay, Annika.
She smiled faintly.
That, as thou hast perceived, would be too confusing. Our ears, will we, nil we, hear all sound. My perception of the thought of others doth require my conscious direction. I must reach out to hear, unless the thought of one who is near me be so intense that it doth become as a shout. So it was with Celasta. His mind doth scream the name of Sophronia again and again. In equal measure, moreover, doth his mind shriek, Thy name, goddess, and those shrieks are filled with his hatred of thee. In his mind art thou a thief, having stolen away all his hope of joy.
A thief? Me? He was the one who was trying to steal what was mine. I put my sister here on this world. She's mine. She's always been mine. How dare he?
Danae's black eyes were flashing, and her voice was filled with outraged indignation. This isn't one of the more attractive sides of your nature, Divine One, Sparhawk suggested. We don't own other people.
I'm not a people, Sparhawk. I own what I want.
You're just digging yourself in deeper. I wouldn't pursue it any further.
But I do, Father. I've devoted hundreds of years to Sophronia, and all that time Zelasta's been sneaking around behind my back trying to steal her from me.
Aphriel, he said gently, you're an Aline in this particular incarnation, so you're going to have to stop thinking like Asteric. There are certain things that decent Alines don't do, and you're doing one of them right now. Sophronia belongs to herself, not to you, not to Zelasta, not even to Vanyan. Her soul's her own.
But I love her!
It was almost a wail. I'm not built right for this, Sparhawk muttered to himself. How can any human hope to be the father of a goddess?
Don't you love me, Father?
Her voice was tiny. Of course I do.
Then you belong to me, too. Why are you arguing with me about it?
You're a primitive.
Of course I am. We're supposed to be primitive. All these years, Zelasta's been pretending to love me, smiling at me, kissing me, holding me while I slept. That wretch, that lying wretch, I'll have his heart for supper for this.
No, as a matter of fact, you won't. I'm not raising a cannibal. You won't eat pork, so don't start developing a taste for people.
I'm sorry, she said contritely. I got excited.
Besides, I think Vanyan's got first claim on Zelasta's tripes.
Oh, dear. I completely forgot about Vanyan. That poor, poor man.
Two great tears welled up in her eyes.
I'll spend the rest of his life making this up to him.
Why don't we let Sophronia take care of that? Just heal the breach between them. That's the only thing he really wants.
Then Sparhawk thought of something.
It won't wash, Zanisha. Zelasta could very well be in love with Sophronia, but he hasn't gone over to Sirgon. When we encountered those trolls in the mountains of Aton, he was the one who saved us from them. And it wasn't just the trolls. There were worse things there as well.
The trolls do not loom large in Sirgon's plan, Zanika. The deaths of 100 of them were of little moment. All else was illusion. Illusion wrought by Zelasta himself to allay certain suspicions in the minds of diverse of thy companions. He sought to win thy trust by destroying those shadows of his own making.
End of Side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.